I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and a broom. A performance-enhancing broom. My name is John Cullen. I'm a comedian, podcaster, and for 20 years, I was a semi-professional curler. And I want to tell you the story about how a single broom almost imploded the 500-year-old sport of curling.
We felt like we were bringing a knife to a gunfight.
It's the story of a superstar and his fall from grace.
Well, I was being dragged through the mud.
It's the story of two brother entrepreneurs with a dream.
Yeah, I said, that's great news.
It's a story of intrigue.
I still don't understand why we want to keep his name secret.
The full story has never been told, so I'm going to tell it. Broomgate, how a broom almost killed curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
To listen to Broomgate, search for Broomgate in your favorite podcast app. That's all one word, Broomgate.
This is the Athletic Hockey Show Prospect Series.
Hey everybody, Max Boltman here alongside Corey Pronman, Scott Wheeler, and Flow Hockey's Chris Peters for another episode of the Athletic Hockey Show's Prospect Series. Gentlemen, we've got a draft order, a chalk draft order, I should say. San Jose and Chicago get the top two picks in the draft. Scott Wheeler, your first reaction?
I was happy. My instant reaction was honestly that I was pretty happy for San Jose. They're the team that needs him the most. They're the team that's furthest away. There's obviously the connections that we're going to hear about ad nauseum. I actually do think that's probably going to get pretty tired here in the next 7 weeks of people talking about Macklin and his dad. I'm sure he'll get tired of talking about his dad and answering questions about Steph Curry and yada, yada, yada. But it's going to be great. He's going to be the face of that franchise. I think he's got a chance to become a little bit of a cult hero there, like a little bit of a local celebrity there if all breaks well. And if he's a part of them returning to where they were a decade ago as one of the sort of perennial contenders in the NHL with a team built around him. So I was excited about that. And it's huge for we'll get into it lots between now and the draft, but it's huge for Chicago. Just getting the pick of the litter after Celebrini is a big, big win, not slipping to third or fourth. That's a big deal for them. The idea of Demidov and Bedard, or adding a player like Lipshunov or Anton Salayev to that blue line with all the size they already have on that blue line coming. There's just a lot to like about the setup now for both of those teams.
When you really think about how the Sharks built their initial success and then their long stretch of being a contender, it started with the Patrick Marleau pick and him becoming a franchise player and all around impactful player. And it doesn't, and I think, as Scott said, this team's really far away. And I think he just kind of like, after Chicago adds Bedard, he drops airdrops in the first year, team's still really bad. Celebrini's gonna might arrive next year, that team's still gonna be really, really bad. But he is the first step to potentially becoming good again, to potentially becoming, a team that could play in the playoffs and make some noise. We'll see how the next 5 years go in San Jose. But this is a guy who has a potential to be an impactful all-around center. And it's a great day if you're a fan of the San Jose Sharks.
Chris, how quick do you think, obviously we see how long it can take some of these guys to make a big impact. We're not even sure that Celebrini will leave college right away next year. How would you approach that as the Sharks? And how quick do you, expect to see Celebrini make an impact?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I think that whatever they do with Celebrini really impacts what they do with Will Smith as well. And do you want those guys on the same timeline in terms of contracts and things like that? They could go either way. If they wait a year or if they do it this year, then all of a sudden...
There's no way he's going back. Come on.
I think there's a chance.
I think there's a chance too.
It's minimal.
Come on.
It's minimal.
He won the Hobie Baker.
That is
he's
a horrific
back.
Situation to be in, Corey.
That I don't
is
a, care. Like, he's not going back.
Suck.
He's not going back. He's
They're
not
terrible.
Going back. Come
They're
on.
Terrible. They're terrible. What benefit does he have going into the NHL next year?
What benefit
does
he have?
Sharks, It benefits the Sharks. It does not benefit him.
Does he have to go and score like 3 points per game?
Shut up! I'm making a point. I'm playing devil's advocate. This is
Chris wants to send him to Europe. Maybe he'd go to the AHL.
I would actually prefer that he plays for the San Jose Barracuda in front of 400.
That's right.
I do think the benefit for him and the strongest case for him to go there is a financial one. It's $3 or $4 million plus bonuses, accelerating his entry level contract. I've spoken to people who think they'd be crazy to sort of leave the money piece of it on the table.
Let's be honest. He's going to be in the NHL next year. We know this. But then that also makes the decision now. Okay. So what do you do with Will Smith? Is he also in the NHL next year?
Yeah.
Having two guys under 20 on your roster, that is an absolute disaster of a roster.
Yeah.
I think is not exactly setting either of those two up for long-term success. And so that's why I think you actually have to have the discussion about how bad is it and how bad are we how long are we allowing these guys to play in that bad of a situation? Because they aren't remotely close to anything. And there is so much that they need between now and when they're going to be competitive. And you think about the different cycles of competitiveness. Like obviously for Chicago, they went through this dark period. They get Jonathan Toews, they get Patrick Kane, you know, that they go and everything's great, but they had also been building up around them for those years prior where there was Duncan Keith and there was Brent Seabrook. And then there was the addition of Patrick Sharp. And then, you know, by the time they were ready to make the big swing free agents picks. And as we look at the free agent class that we're in, that we're about to head in right now, there's not a lot there that's going to help in the near term. There's not a lot of guys that are going to be available. So, I mean, I think that the thing is you have to have Rick Celebrini actually spoke to the media yesterday during a Golden State Warriors press conference and was asked about this very thing. And I think, yes, they're going to have that conversation. I do think he'll be in the NHL next year, but like everything from here on out, yes, you won Macklin Celebrini. Your job just got a heck of a lot harder because now you have to make sure that you are building around him effectively and quickly. And that's the thing that I think Mike Greer is going to have a real challenge in doing, is that there are so many things they need. There are so many, some of the guys that they've picked in the last few years aren't exactly going to be core pieces for them. You know, will William Mecklen? Maybe. Will Thomas Bortolo? Maybe. I mean, but, you know, are they truly going to be core pieces down the road? You know, you have your two guys that you can kind of use as your centerpieces, but I think there's just still such a long way to go that I'd be really nervous about what happens next.
So I think this goes back to something Scott. Scott at the very beginning talked about being like happy for the Sharks, right? And I do feel like justice was kind of served here. I know people have talked about it.
Yes.
Them tank. Like this was a team that pushed the pedal to the metal for a really long time. This was inevitable that they were going to get in this position. And it's good that they got it. But to Chris's point, all of a sudden now you are like pretty similar to Chicago getting Bedard, honestly. Like there's a lot of pieces that still need to come into this organization. And when you said like effectively and quickly, I almost think you got to chop the quickly off of that. And you just have to focus on doing it effectively. I agree. Celebrini's probably going to be in the NHL next year, but if you want to slow play a lot of those other guys and let this thing, you know, chug along so that, because they don't really have any big time defenseman prospects in the system yet. They're going to need to build that out. They're going to need another couple years picking in the top five or so. I don't think they need to do anything to rush to do that, even though obviously you want to put good people around Macklin Celebrini.
Yeah, I mean, I think the quickly thing is that, you know, how long do you want to have this dark cloud hanging over your organization where you're, you know, winning 20 games a season? You know, like that's the thing where it's because, I mean, I think in terms of what Macklin Celebrini is going to be able to do immediately, you know, I think that it's fair to assume that there's that potential to have a similar rookie season to a Connor Bedard. And Chicago obviously tried to put pieces in place around Bedard. They had the Taylor Hall injury that kind of blew things up. But they still had some decent veterans around them. They also had guys that were on the come up like Alex Vlasic. And so there were definitely things there that, you know, made that a little bit more of a tenable situation. And I you know, I just look at San Jose and I'm just like, what is it? Like, where does it go from here? Because now you've got your two guys but not a whole lot else. So, yeah, the thing about the quickly thing is really, you just don't want to get into a situation where you're like the Buffalo Sabres were, where they started they tore everything down probably at the wrong time, just in terms of what was available in the draft coming forward. And they're still paying for that. You know, you think about that, the many, you know, the whatever, 14 years without playoffs there. You know, that's if you're not careful about your rebuild, that's the potential of the darkness that befalls your organization.
They also made some decisions, though, with the idea of, you know, competing with Jack, like giving Jeff Skinner this big deal, that are still biting them and limiting them in the short term. So there's a trade-off for all that. Sorry, Scott.
Absolutely.
No, I was just going to say, I opened their cap sheet immediately after the draft on Cap Friendly, and I was shocked at what it looked like, even for 2024, 2025. I think they have two forwards signed, Fabian Zetterlund, I believe, and one other forward are signed for next season. They've got one or two defensemen signed. Like, it is as empty as a cap sheet can possibly be. So when Chris was talking about the expediency of it, I think of just between June 28th when they pick him. Now they can preempt some of these conversations, but between June 28th when they pick him and July 1st, they're going to need to know whether he's coming and whether he's playing in the NHL next year, because they're going to want to make decisions in free agency accordingly. And that doesn't mean accelerating the process, but it means maybe doing what Chicago did and bringing in your sort of Nick Foligno types on 2-3 year deals to bridge that gap. And at least surround him with guys who can play at a level that they maybe weren't playing at a year ago.
Or taking on people's problems.
Seems
like a likely scenario there too.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Let's go to the team that got the second pick here in Chicago. And obviously you'd love to pair Celebrini with Bedard, but they still come out of this in a really good place, Corey. As Scott said, their pick of the litter of the next bunch. And it seems like in the early discussion, this looks like a race between Ivan Demidov and Artem Livshunov. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think those are considered the top guys in the draft. I think depending on who you talk to, some would throw an Anton Saliev into that mix. Some might even throw a Caden Lindstrom or Sam Dickinson into that mix too. But our colleague Scott Powers thinks that those are the two names they're debating right now. And for my lean, if that was the case, I think if you are close between the 5'11 wing and the 6'2 mobile defenseman, I think when it's all said and done, I think you take the defenseman. Now, that might be said, if they don't think it's close, then you take the wing. Because if you think Demidov is the next Kucherov or the next Panarin, then obviously that's a little bit of a different analysis. But I think it's at least close between those two. And for those reasons, I would lean towards Livshunov for their pick.
What do you think, Scott?
The more I've thought about it over the last couple of days, the more I've sort of felt myself thinking that the other direction is the play here. I love Artem. I think he could be a number one, number two type first pairing guy for them. The length, the skating, the defensive upside with how physically strong he is, how quickly he's progressed over the last 2 years in North America, and the likelihood that that's going to continue to take place for him here. But you look at the playoffs right now, it's a league in terms of who's left that's being dominated by duos, right? It's up front in particular. It's MacKinnon and Rantanen, Barkov and Tkachuk. Sam Reinhart's kind of joined that duo as well. Pasternak and Marchand, McDavid and Dreisaitl are obviously a class above. This is their opportunity, I think, to get that second guy, that second true star player. And if they believe that Demidov can be that for them, the idea of him and Bedard, the potential complement on Bedard's wing, they play very different games, the power play fit. There's a lot to like about the potential of building with two kids from the exact same birth year. We forget that because of Demidov's late birth year. A lot of things just really align with the two of them together moving forward, I think. But they're in a can't lose situation. Like, those two players in particular, I think, are both going to hit. Obviously you've got a little bit of sort of logistics and practicalities to figure out in conversations with Demidov. Chicago, I'm sure, will be in Florida at the end of next month to sort of meet with Demidov as part of Gold Star's showcase that they're planning there. But it's going to come down to those conversations with Demidov, and then they're going to have to make a very difficult decision as far as the future goes. But just the idea of the two of them together, I think, is really, really exciting. And I think it would be, for selfish reasons, I think it would be great for TV as well, and for what that could look like in terms of how much fun they could be having on the ice in the prime of their careers.
What I think is interesting is how quickly you rattled off all those scorer names and how many of them are left in the NHL are in the playoffs. And I'm trying to think of how many legit number one defensemen are left in the playoffs. You know, I'm thinking of guys like Miro Heiskanen. I'm thinking of Charlie McAvoy. But I feel like that player type to me is a little bit more rare. That's just my, that's just the way I see it.
Yeah, the other, so the thing about what Scott said too, the idea of which one of them is going to hit on the highest projection. That's the thing that I'm kind of curious about. I think both will hit as well. It's which one will hit on the highest projection. And, you know, I think Demidov, to me, when I watch him and I, you know, you look at his body of work and the different things that, that we've seen from him. And I think that there is, you know, still an element of risk because he's done, you know, he's absolutely dominated the Russian U-20 league, which is impressive in some ways, but in other ways, it's, I don't love that level of hockey in terms of being an indicator for future success. But what I do think is there's a little bit more wiggle room between, you know, if you believe that Levshinov is going to be a top pairing defenseman, you're very confident that he's going to be a top pairing defenseman. I think that does make it a little bit easier to make that pick. But if you're not convinced of that, I do think that it really comes back to that, that idea that, that the winger might be a little bit safer of the projection. I think that there's no doubt in my mind, which, I mean, there always should be doubt, but, you know, there's marginal doubt about whether or not, you know, Demidov is going to be a top line winger. I'm pretty certain he's the way that he plays, what he's shown so far. You know, I'd love to get official measurements from him, you know, to figure out in terms of the size, the weight. You know, I think he's a strong player, but I look at his skill, his hockey sense, his physical tools, his hand skills, all those things. I just feel more comfortable saying that he'll hit on his projection than I do with Levshinov, who I think is the best defenseman in this draft, and the most likely to be a guy that could be a top pairing number one potential defenseman in this class. So it is a great debate, and it's one that I think Chicago will continue to take to the wire here. I think they will do their due diligence and really, but I do think it will be down to those two guys.
I mean, obviously, there's other number one defensemen I skimmed over. Quinn Hughes, you know, Cale Makar, and Adam Fox. But I was thinking of, like, the two-way, like, you know, guys with the size and the high-end skating. One thing that I think is interesting in the Demidov discussion, and this doesn't apply to Scott, because I think Scott had him, like, two or three on his list from point A to point B this season, is I do think it's strange that, like, he's kind of emerging as a consensus number two or number three prospect. And it's like, well, he had a great playoff. And I'm like, you know, he was like the MVP of that league last season, right? Like, it's, I don't think anybody reasonable would have expected him to do anything other than dominate the regular season in the NHL this year and dominate the playoffs in the league this year. And if you liked him already in that range, that's fine. But I just think it's interesting that, like, it's like, oh, look how good a playoffs he had. He's rising. It's like, really? Like, he had like 1.5 points per game in the league. You know, a year and a half ago, I think that to me is an interesting part of the Demidov gut dialogue.
This doesn't necessarily impact the pick between Demidov and Levshinov because neither of them is a center. But I've been thinking about it as people have talked about kind of Demidov as a wing for Bedard. How sure are we at 1 year in? Like, can we take as a given that Bedard is going to be, he's got 39% faceoff percentage. We knew this was a question coming out in his draft year, Corey. Like, are you sure that Bedard's a center? Should Chicago be operating as though Bedard is a 15-year center for them?
Well, I mean, there are other options in their system now, is Nazar and Moore. They're not exactly giants either, although Moore's skating, I think, gives you some confidence. He can stick down the middle. And I think, you know, I don't know, we'll see what long-term, but it wasn't there like points there towards the end of the year where Jack Hughes was being played at wing by New Jersey, and probably for those similar reasons. I think with Bedard, he's so special, and quite frankly, they're so bad that I think you have to give him every opportunity to play down the middle and prove it. But that frame will be a concern. And I mean, faceoffs are not the most major aspect of centers in the modern NHL, but it's a variable for sure. Like, you see guys, you know, play the middle, but may not take the faceoff, something like that, or something along those lines. But it's a little bit of a concern there. I do like the synergy between the two of them, though, in that I think Demidov's an elite playmaker, and then you have Bedard with the elite goal scoring elements. I do think there is a synergy element there, although I wouldn't draft based on that at two. I think at two, when your team is that bad, you have to take whoever you think is the best player. But I think just thinking out loud in terms of how those two would play together, I think there's definitely a way to make that work. Although, like I said, I think it would be interesting kind of seeing how that four group would come together, because I just it feels like that, you know, I feel like that's kind of in Chicago's type, is high compete, high skill types, and while sacrificing a little bit on the size front. They have a lot of work left there to do anyway. So I think they'll get, even if they were to draft Demidov there too, I think they have plenty of more bad years ahead of them to draft a bigger forward.
Coincidentally, Demidov did an interview with Russian Press yesterday where he said he wants to learn how to play center moving forward here. So not that a team should be banking on that or projecting for that, but it doesn't seem like it's something he's opposed to. And we saw another Russian in Danila Yurov switch from the wing to center and have a ton of success in the KHL this year because of that switch and the way it fit his game. And I do think there are some similarities between Yurov and Demidov that way in terms of the way they think it.
I think Michkov tried it in the last like 10 days.
Yeah.
It's always easier said than done. It's always easier.
And you know, Max, before we move on from the Blackhawks, I think it is important to say why most of us aren't talking about Silaev as an option for them. You look at their entire future of their blue line; they're all left shot defensemen. I mean, it's Korchinski, it's Vlasic, with the exception Sam Rinzell is the only one that has like a higher end projection than in that system. So that's why like Silaev doesn't seem to fit as much in there. I think Korchinski is going to be their long-term guy on the left side. Vlasic is their number one shutdown defenseman for the long term, you know, so that's
I think you have to at least entertain Silaev there though. He has to be in the conversation. 6'7", mobile, physical, you know, KHL power play guy at 17. Like I think he has to be in the conversation for Chicago at 2. And you know, I think there are people around the league, quite frankly, who would take him at 2. I would not, even though we've been talking about the other two, I would not rule out Silaev as an option there.
Anybody have any non-San Jose Chicago lottery thought? When we have a chalk draft, or there's nobody that really gets punished with a fall or anything like that, but was there anyone whose spot in this thing? I guess maybe it's Pittsburgh losing their pick to San Jose. Any non-lottery winner thoughts here?
I'm fascinated to see what Montreal is going to do at 5. You know, Kent Hughes has been very vocal about the desire for a forward. I think in my mock, I had Caden Lindstrom available to them and them taking him. But I think Montreal is another team that still has a lot of work to do, a lot of roster building to do. And you think, okay, well, if you have your belief in David Reinbacher and Logan Mailloux as you know, the future of the blue line. But I mean, I think the guys that are available at 5, the defensemen that are available at 5, I like better than Reinbacher, you know? So like, that's the other thing is like, if you are going to be in, and I mean, you know, we've had these Reinbacher debates before. I've been a little bit lower on him than others. And, you know, I think that this D class in particular is really fascinating. You know, you've got Mailloux, you've got Hudson, you got all those guys, but you know, when you see the level of defensemen that's potentially going to be available at 5, and you've kind of say, you know, we'd love to get a forward there. You know, you'd probably have to have a lot of belief in Caden Lindstrom. And as you know, we talked about on the last podcast, as I talked to scouts about Caden Lindstrom, it turns out that injury stuff is a concern. A lot of them are talking about it and talking about how important the medicals are going to be on him. And so that's another thing. If he's the number two center on your board after Celebrini, and that's the guy you want, and certainly he would make, he makes you bigger, more physical, all those different things, you know, then maybe that is the pick. But at the same time, you know, you're just, is that that's a bit of a risk situation there, even at 5. You know, so I just think there's a lot of interesting discussions around what Montreal can do, given the range that they're in. And I believe you guys in your team mock draft traded that pick down. So, you know, like that is, and which would be interesting. I mean, I think there's certainly a potential for that. And I think the value of these defensemen is going to make that trade up scenario very attractive to some teams. So we'll have to see how that all shakes out.
I think when you're in a position like Anaheim and you have, say, Leo Carlson, Trevor Zegras, Mason McTavish, already in the NHL, even a guy like Troy Terry, a little bit, you know, older, but he's still a relatively, you know, in his prime age player. And then you have someone like a top prospect like Cutter Gauthier coming. I think when you're in that position, you could start talking about, do we have too much here and not enough somewhere else? But I think if you're Montreal, I don't think you have enough high-end defensemen in your organization to where you can exclude defensemen from the conversation. Right. I've had this conversation with people about Chicago. I don't think with Chicago you could exclude defensemen because you have Ethan Del Mastro and Sam Rinzell and Alex Vlasic and Isaac Phillips and you know, and Nolan Allen. That's not elite players, enough of them anyways, to exclude defensemen from your conversation. So I'm not saying, I understand why people think Montreal should take a 4 out of 5. I understand that if you look at the pipeline, that's there's a little bit more of a need there. But just because you have Lane Hutson and Logan Mailloux and Justin Barron and Caden Gooley and David Reinbacher, you know, odds are those some of those guys will become really good NHL players. And odds are one of those two guys are going to miss, just like completely miss. And then one or two of those guys become like nice players, nothing special. I when you're at that point in the draft, you probably need so much.
Is it fair to say, though, Corey, with Lane Hutson, like, does he factor into how you would think about a Ziv Bouyim or a Zane Parekh for them? Or does he also meet that level of like, well, we haven't seen it at the NHL yet, so it wouldn't stop you from those guys?
It wouldn't stop me. I understand if you really are a Lane believer and you think he's going to run your first power play for the next 10 years, then, I mean, then you have to think about that. I think anybody who's drafting Parekh or Bouyim have to at least consider that, given that that is how you will maximize their value is by running your first power play unit. But yeah, my personal opinion is I would not exclude those two just because I have Lane Hutson in my organization.
Cool. All right, good stuff. We're going to take a quick break, come back, talk about some of the risers out of the U18 Worlds and other takeaways from that tournament. Be right back.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right, we're back. And hopefully by now, guys, you're all kicked the jet lag from your travels to the U18 World Championships. You got a heck of a finish to that tournament. I think it was Chris who, when I asked...
No pun intended.
That's right. When I asked you what you were looking forward to in the medal round, Chris, you just begged the gods for a USA-Canada final. You got it, and it went off in spectacular fashion.
That's one way to put it. I mean, like, it was a crazy game. I mean, obviously, there was so much hype and so much, you know, just with what James Hagans was doing in the tournament, with what Gavin McKenna was doing in the tournament, you know, and it is actually upsetting how far away both USA and Canada were from everyone else in that tournament. It really, like, that tournament, the quality of the under 18 World Championship this year was so below its standard, which was kind of annoying, but at the same time, you get this fantastic final. We've talked about it before. Scott mentioned it before about the, you know, when we had that terrible Summer World Juniors, but then Mason McTavish had a moment and it kind of saved the whole thing. You know, that's basically what we saw. And, you know, I know we're going to get into it, but, you know, it's this gold medal game that's going one way and then it completely flips on its head with 10 and a half minutes to go and everything changes. And all of a sudden you're just like, what did I just witness? What just happened? And what happened was not good things for USA and great things for Canada.
The first half of the game, I think you saw a US team that, other than maybe like Hagans, doesn't have like a ton of eye popping talent on their team that was just going to dominate the game. But they were so deep; they had three lines that they can roll. They trusted their defensemen. They were controlling possession. Even though it was only a one goal game before the Trevor Connolly major, it was a game they were in control of. And I know Scott's going to talk about this, but like Canada didn't trust, it felt like half their roster at times. They didn't trust, you know, anything other than two centers and Jet Luchenko and Cole Beaudoin. They were kind of, you know, by the end of it, I think they were only playing two defense pairs there regularly. And it was just like, it just felt like USA was really in control. Canada was stressing out over their matchups with Higgins on the ice and even Trevor Connolly to an extent. And it really felt like USA was dictating that game for 70% of the game.
Well, the one thing that leapt out at me was, and Corey kind of touched on it there, but the lack of options down the middle for Canada and the way that influenced the way that Gardner McDougall coached that team. Like, it was just defensive zone draw or James Higgins was on the ice and Cole Beaudoin was going over the boards, whether it was his turn, whether he needed to slot in as the center with two other wingers that he hadn't played much with. They were chasing that game. They were on the back foot. Gardner McDougall, who did not lose a single game in the 2023-2024 season, said, and I quote post game, that he thought his team had no hope in the second period. Those are crazy words out of the mouth of a head coach who's trying to win a hockey game, right? And that's just the way that the game was going. That USA seemed to roll their lines. I thought USA's fourth line with Brendan McMorrow, Lucas Van Veet, and Shane Vansagi was excellent in the tournament and in that game, and a difference in that game. Just the depth, the ability to roll the lines. I thought LJ Mooney had a really good tournament. Like, there were just... It felt like there were waves coming with the American group that the Canadian group didn't have. And there were several players on the Canadian group that just never really settled into their roles in the tournament, and others like Caleb Desnoyers that were maybe in a little bit above their heads. And as a result, it just felt like this game was going to get away from Canada until the Trevor Connolly hit, and then three goals on a 5-minute power play and everything changes.
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting. So, you know, Corey talked about how Gardner McDougall was so focused on the matchups, and he was to almost to the detriment of some of the forwards on his team. But James Higgins and Teddy Stiga did not score in that game. And that really ultimately was what allowed them to, they were a great line together, you know, and then Trevor Connolly was kind of doing his thing. And they actually, that whole matchup ends up changing the tide of the game. At one point, Nick Four puts Trevor Connolly with James Higgins and Teddy Stiga to try to get that line going. They have a tremendous shift. They dominate in the offensive zone. They control the puck for almost a full minute. And then as Canada's about to get the puck back and get it out of the zone, all of a sudden things change. The entire game changes. Trevor Connolly levels. Was it Luchenko? Ryder Ritchie. Thank you. Yeah, Ryder Ritchie right in the noggin. 5-10. Three power play goals later, USA's out of it. And so it's amazing how that, like, the long game somehow worked out. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't until that power play where Canada actually was able to start generating offense.
How many times have we seen in a junior tournament like this that a Canadian team or an American team with a loaded offense gets a major penalty? And it could be against like a Slovakia or Latvia, and they get one goal on it, maybe two. But to get three goals on a major in that kind of game is something that you don't see very often.
No, insane. Go ahead, Scott. Sorry.
I was just gonna say full credit for Carter George getting them there in the first place too, right? Like that,
yes.
That game might be even more out of hand. And then three goals doesn't get you to the finish line like it did unless Carter George is just excellent in the first two periods.
All right, so let's talk about some of the prospects themselves now here, Corey, and not just in the gold medal game here, the whole tournament. Who on Team Canada do you think helped themselves the most at this event?
I think it was those two centers I just mentioned in Jet Luchenko and Cole Beaudoin. I think they both showed the traits that NHL scouts think are going to translate up levels. Luchenko with his speed and his compete and ability to make plays. He was running the second power play on the flank there, for example, and a guy who can, on top of being a guy you can play both ways. Cole Beaudoin, I think, is just a super high-end competitor with size who can show some offense, scores the game-winning goal, for example, at the front of the net there. And skating isn't amazing, but I think it's okay enough to play in the NHL. I think they both have potential to be maybe third line centers in the NHL, guys who can play significant defensive responsibilities in the NHL. And then, of course, I think you know the TJ Ginla hype train's in full gear right now. I don't think he was their best forward there. He wasn't even their second best forward there. But he was an important forward for them. He was an important reason for why they won a gold medal. He's a guy who showed a ton of skill, the ability to score goals. He made some plays, including on an important play to score up, to set up, I believe it was McKenna's first goal in the gold medal game. And he competed hard he didn't play a ton in the gold medal game, but in the semifinal game that they had to win against Sweden, which was an important game, a contested game, he played a massive amount in that game and played really well. And I think Ginla is trending towards being a very high draft pick.
How about you, Chris? Anybody really pop for you?
You know, I think the guys that Corey mentioned certainly did. You know, I don't think that one of the guys that I was most interested to watch in this setting was Charlie Ellick from Canada. He's a really good skater. He's solid defensively, physical. I think it was interesting to watch his role diminish some as the tournament progressed and see, I didn't think that was necessarily helpful, but I think you could still see that the tools and the different things that he brings to the table in some of the earlier games. I think that just the lack of offensive hockey sense is the concern there. He at least intrigued me. So I guess if we're looking more for risers, I really think the guys that Corey mentioned were the clear risers from Team Canada. Looking at some of the other teams, like there wasn't a ton of guys that really did jump out at you. That was like, wow, they significantly helped themselves in this tournament. But Carson Wetch is another guy where I think he's going to be a player that teams are looking at for. He's not a high end guy. Like, he's not going to be a big producer, but he was so good on the forecheck, and his speed and his size and his physicality. You could say, oh, that guy absolutely has a place in the NHL. Could probably be an earlier day two pick as a result. But those are the kind, at least from Canada, those were some of the guys that really kind of stood out to me as the guys I was watching closely.
How about from Team USA, Scott?
Well, I think the Emery-Hudson pairing was tremendous. They were searching all year long on that blue line. There were a lot of question marks about that American blue line early on this season. They really fought the puck at times early on this season. That blue line, I think, frankly, and some of the goaltending issues they had earlier in the year lost them some games that they shouldn't have lost. So it was really nice in the second half of this season in particular to see Emery's defensive game really emerge. The skating and the length and the athleticism has always been his calling card, but just his ability to close on pucks, to go back and to retrieve pucks. I made a number of comments sitting next to Chris and Peters Chris and Corey throughout the tournament, where he would go back on a puck and sort of give the guy a shoulder fake with his back turned to him and exit the zone. Just little things that he wasn't doing a year ago. I think Emery's one of the most improved players on this team over the course of their 2 years together at the program. And suddenly, I think Emery's quite likely going to be a first-round pick. You look at the second half of the first round and the defensemen that have a chance to go in that range, it's not a big group. And I think Emery has sort of emerged at the front of that group just because of the skating and the way that he defended. Nick Ford talked about it, how they wanted him this year to become the best defensive defenseman in that age group. And he was pretty close by the end of the year to that conversation. So a credit to Emery. And then the other one, I mean, we talked about him a little bit. I thought Teddy Stiga was a driver, and not just because he was playing with James Haggins. There were games where in the first period of games, it was him that was pulling everybody else into the fight, him making that first big play, scoring that first big goal in a game. Teddy's a 5'10", 5'11 winger, which complicates the projection in terms of the NHL. But with the way that he works, the way that he skates, I think he's an above average skater. He's got above average skill. He's got some craft and creativity to his game. There's a very good player there, and I think he's going to surprise some people at Boston College next year and have a really solid freshman year. So Stieg is another one that sort of was kind of a second, third round pick for most of this year for most teams. And now you start to wonder, okay, how early on day two can he go? And will a team maybe even consider him sort of in the late 20s or early 30s?
I think there's going to be some hard conversations in NHL scouting departments this summer about Cole Hudson too. Yeah. I think just given how good he was at the tournament, he was really good at the last year's tournament there too. I think there were some times this year where I wasn't blown away by him, and I think that goes into the conversation with Cole. But just given the success that Lane has had at Boston University, I think the teams are at least like looking at this player and wondering is this going to happen, you know, in a very similar way again? Is there some differences between the two players that make you think he could have more or less success? I don't know where I lean on Cole right now or where he's going to go in the draft. I just know there's a lot of hard conversations going on about him right now.
Speaking of hard conversations, one of the guys we talked about on the last episode that maybe wanted to see a little bit more from at this event was Liam Greentree, who had a spectacular season in the OHL for Windsor. Quieter tournament here. I know Scott talked in the last episode about him maybe being kind of one of those victims of the, you know, shortened bench, so to speak, for Team Canada, Corey. But what do you think the outlook is for Liam Greentree coming out of this event?
I don't think the comp is perfect, but when I wrote an article about a week or so ago, talking about lessons from the 2019 draft, and I kind of drew a line between Greentree and Arthur Kaliev, in that I think, you know, both are not the best skaters, not the highest compete level kind of players, but scored at really high rates in junior hockey. Really skilled, intelligent players, goal scorers. And so I look at these two situations and I do wonder if Greentree does get maybe a little bit later into the first round, early second. I almost think of Quentin Musty too. Where did Musty go? Like round 25 or so. I can see some similarities in connecting those player types there too. So I do wonder if Greentree, who we thought might be a top 20 pick after the tournament, maybe goes more towards like into the 20s.
And then Cole Iserman, Chris, obviously we've talked about him plenty on the show. We don't have to belabor the point, but I know we talked about wanting to see a big statement from him in the medal round. He does come through with the three goals that he needs to become the all-time goals leader. But has the outlook really changed fundamentally for Cole from where he was coming into this tournament to where he is now?
Yeah, I don't think so. And it's crazy to say that about a guy that had 9 goals in a tournament like this, you know, and I think that the one thing that as you talk to scouts out there, there's like these instances and you look at the two games where he didn't score goals. I think those are the games where you say one of those games, Team USA scored 9 goals. He didn't have one of them. And he didn't look himself. We talked about it. I think that was the last time we talked. Well, the thing about that is I think that there are some growing concerns about, you know, his overall sense, you know, in terms of, you know, if he's not impacting the game the way that he thinks he should be, does he compound that with other mistakes and not playing to his identity? So like it's such a weird discussion because, you know, I want to see more from him. I want to see more of a goal scorer. But then when he's not scoring and you're like, I would rather like him when he's trying to do all the goal scoring things, you know, because he's a little bit more playing to his identity. You know, so that it's tough. You know, I think that some of the other games where you saw him get the goals, especially in the medal round, I think against Slovakia, he played a more physical game. He was getting, you know, he actually almost got a major penalty. You know, they took it off the board when they realized that he hit the guy in the shoulder and not the head. But, you know, like that's he was engaged physically. He was competing at a higher level. But I look at some of the one-on-one skills. I worry about that. You know, he was having a hard time beating defenders. He was having a hard time getting shots through at various times. And we've talked about his shot selection, his decision-making, all those different things. And that comes back to that hockey sense as well. And so I do think that there is a stronger chance that he's going to slip toward. I think he's still going to be picked among the lottery teams, but I think it's going to be towards the back end of that. And I think that, you know, guys like Tiija Ginla, you know, Konsta Helenius, Berkeley Catton have I think vaulted themselves a fair amount past him on where a good number of teams will be, you know, slotting those players.
Feels like Senecky has joined that group too, which complicates it further for a player like Iserman.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would be fairly confident that Senecky's going to go ahead of Iserman on draft day.
Well, that's a good tease into the mailbag. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we've got a packed mailbag to get to. A lot of draft stuff. Stick around for that. All right, let's get to the mailbag here, guys. And CV Sports Guy wants to know, Corey, you just talked about him in the last segment. How much did Cole Beaudoin help his draft stock with his U18 performance? And a newer topic here, who are some other players who have a similar game with the size and compete combo? He also says skating in there.
Yeah, and I'm not sure his skating's amazing, to be quite honest. I think that's actually people's biggest issue with him, but I can talk about that in general. I think I was pretty high on Cole Beaudoin coming into the tournament. I think I had him, whatever, around like, my last list, what was it, like 20, 21, 22 kind of thing. And I think I might have moved him up one or two spots since then, but But I think that's pretty similar to where I have him. But I think that's going to become, I think, more of an emerging consensus here after the tournament. I think he's going to go around that, say, 18 to 25 range in the draft. I think he's worked his way to being a very solid first round pick just because of how likable his game is. His work ethic is off the charts. He's big, and there is a little bit of offense there in his game too, to where you see a way that he could become a really nice pro and an NHL center that people are going to want to build around. In terms of thinking of guys like him, in terms of the really high end compete, I think, that's a good question. I don't think as a forward it's the same thing, but I think Stian Solberg, the defenseman in Norway, is making a lot of people like him just because of how competitive that player is. He's 6'2", he's mobile, he's super physical. He had a great end to his season there with his club team in Norway. He's going to go to the Men's World Championship now, and I think if he shows he can defend against men already at this age, I think he's going to be a guy who can stir some conversation in terms of just how competitive he is and elevate his profile a little bit. We've talked about him before, but just Jet Luchenko, I think his compete's really, really strong. And I think this is a guy who, I think last episode I said he's elevated from a late first, early second to a mid to late first. I think just my conversations, I think he's going to be a mid first. I think I feel pretty confident he's going in the top 20 of this year's draft. And for those reasons.
He trades the size in, right? He's only 5'11", but he's got the much better wheels.
I think of Frank Nazar a lot when I think of that player, for example. And I think there's a lot of similarities.
A comp for Baudouin, Nathan Gauthier from a couple seasons ago. Is that a similar kind of profile there?
Yeah, I think that's on the money there. And Gauthier went around the 20 spot. I think this guy might have a little bit more pure offense and maybe trades back an inch. But I think there's a little bit more hockey sense there than Gauthier had.
Yeah. Gauthier was a better skater too.
Yeah, fair. All right, this next one will be for you, Scott. It's from Kraus Oben. We hear about how players rank from 3 to 8 on draft lists, maybe virtually interchangeable. Need aside, how do team scouts and analysts rank players who are seemingly equal in their respective upside?
Well, I think ultimately they start at what position they play. We see it every year. And I think in building my mock, my first mock draft that came out today, and in speaking with scouts over the last few days since I returned from Finland, just exchanging some texts with people, I think there's a consensus yet again, surprise, surprise, that some of those wingers and some of the smaller centers are going to inevitably linger on boards longer than people realize. And I think ultimately that those tend to be the deciding factors. It's, can this kid be, if it's a defenseman, can he be a top four guy? And teams will always put a premium on that, even if they really like the available forward. I think we're going to see that in this draft. I would expect that 5 of the top 6 defensemen, and you can kind of select any 5, but 5 of those top 6 defensemen are probably going to go in the first 8 or 9 picks. And as a result, you do the math, you start to count how many forwards there are also in that second group. Even if teams have them slotted closely together with some of those defensemen, it's just an inevitability that 2 or 3 of Helenius, Iserman, Senecki, Patton, we'll see what happens with medicals in terms of Caden Lindstrom. Multiple of those guys are going to be available outside the top 10, even if they're viewed in this so-called sort of 3 to 8 conversation that has emerged in this group. So I think that's ultimately the deciding factor for most teams when they sit down at the table, is the wingers just tend to have a tougher time, especially if you're a 5'10", 5'11 winger, right? Like those guys always, you go back all the way back to Cole Caulfield, Alex DeBrincat, on and on and on. Those guys always just tend to linger, even if on talent they belong with players who are drafted in front of them.
I think the biggest variable is position, and then the second biggest variable is, are they a Russian?
Chris, Nabil Raymond wants to know, he says, Beckett Seneca is definitely this year's riser, like Cutter Gauthier and Mason McTavish in past years. Do you think he could end up going as high, like top 5 high, as those two did?
I don't think it's going to be that high, but he's certainly, entered that top 10 conversation. I mean, I think that's been the real remarkable thing. Like, the interesting thing about this year's draft is I really think that those defensemen are going to really dictate how that top 8, 9 go. And then also, whether or not the decision on some of the centers that we're seeing, being picked and things like that. So there's a lot of different things that I think will come into play. But, you know, those two guys went a lot higher. The other thing is, like, Mason McTavish's rise was, you know, during that weird season where, you know, he was playing in Switzerland, you know, like there was all these different kind of variables that it was really hard to get a handle on where certain guys were going to go. Meanwhile, Cutter Gauthier, you know, his rise wasn't just within the last, like, not to say that Seneca's rise is only because of his, only because of the playoffs that he's had, which is absolutely a driving factor of that. But, you know, I felt like Gauthier's rise was a lot longer than most people realized, you know, so that was the other thing where it wasn't like he had a great under 18s and now he's, you know, because he had an okay under 18s, you know, it was like he was already kind of moving in that direction as a bigger forward. But I mean, you think about the size, the right shot, you think about the goal scoring that he's had, the work ethic that he's playing with, the just, you know, at the toughest time of the year, being a driving player for his team in the postseason. All those things are putting him in from a guy that, you know, I think was kind of towards the 20s into a guy that's going to be in that 10 to 15, 16 range. Like we're talking about, you know, he was in the lottery range in my first lottery mock. I think that there's a good chance that he goes in that range as well. But yeah, I mean, one of those players that has moved along. So not quite top three, top five, but obviously if you can make a move from 20 to 10 at this stage of the game, it's kind of incredible.
Yeah. If I was doing a mock now, I wouldn't have him in the top five, but I think he's got a really strong chance to go in the top 10. I think he's in that conversation right now.
All right, Corey, this one's from JP Hendricks, who says, what justifies the gap in your eyes between Caden Lindstrom and Berkeley Catton? Is there a risk with Catton translatability at the NHL level where Lindstrom's skill set would shine more and Catton would have a harder time impacting the game to the point he becomes a lesser player? Basically, why the gap between Lindstrom and Catton?
I think with those two players, you know, I think with Catton, the size is definitely the biggest concern. But I think everything else in that guy's game is a major positive. I think he's a really good skater. I think he's really skilled. I think he's really smart. I think he's competitive. I think he can score goals. TJ Ginla is supposed to be the goal scorer of that draft age group from the West, but Catton had more goals than him this season in the Western Hockey League. So I just think this guy does so much at a high level. And then with Lindstrom, you know, obviously he's an elite athlete, 6'3", he can fly, he's super physical. You know, I was talking to a scout the other day, I think he eloquated the Lindstrom debate really well. He's like, if you believe he has decent enough hockey sense, you think he can be a star, because now you're talking about a 6'3 guy who could fly, he has skill, he could score, he's physical, and he makes some plays. If you think that, you think he's a star. If you don't think he's smart enough, then you're thinking, okay, maybe he's like a second line player, or at least second line center, maybe a fringy first line wing guy who's really, really good, but not a premium player. And, you know, and for me, talking about those two players, you know, before you get into the injury stuff with Lindstrom or anything along those lines, because unless I learn anything new, injuries, especially a back injury, is concerning, but I think you got to presume he's going to be fine. You know, if he's a young athlete, he should be able to recover. Is that I think about when they were on the same team 9 months ago at the Hlinka Gretzky, and not only was Catton better, he was miles better. Like Lindstrom, they couldn't play Lindstrom towards the end of that gold medal game, whereas they just kept rolling Catton over and over and over again. And I understand that was 9 months ago, but Lindstrom played like 25 games since then. And so I don't understand the conversation that all of a sudden one guy is significantly better than the other guy when 9 months ago, the other guy was significantly better than that guy. So that's where I have trouble with this conversation, and I think Caden Lindstrom is going to go really, really high in this year's draft. But I just not the way I see it from what I've seen of those two players.
All right, Scott, this one's from Matt Manier. He says, this question likely won't get asked. Joke's on you, Matt. Which player is the analytics darling of the 2024 draft?
Oh, there are probably two or three players that immediately come to mind. Obviously, Zane Parekh, you look at any sort of public model, Byron Bader's sort of the typical go-to for most. Byron's model thinks that Zane is not just going to be a good player, but is like a superstar echelon projectable defenseman in terms of the production piece of the puzzle. Miles ahead of where recent very talented OHLD like Grant Clark and Pavel Mintiukov were at, for example. So Zane's a natural one just because the counting stats are so off the chart. And
how
and
similar also, are his numbers to like Bouchard?
Bouchard was, yeah, close enough. I mean, Bouchard played for the London Knights, so that's always a factor. Whereas, I mean, Saginaw was good this year, but he led that team in scoring by 30 points as a defenseman. I don't know whether Bouchard ever got there, but Bouchard was 70, 80 points.
87.
Yeah.
87 yeah, yeah. after, yeah.
Yeah. So and Bouchard's a 70 point defenseman in the NHL yep. right now, right? So he comes to mind. And then the two kids over in Europe, surprisingly, and we talked about Demidov earlier, surprisingly, despite the fact that he hasn't played international hockey really, and despite the fact that he hasn't played in the KHL, or at least hardly at all, in terms of the models and the analytics piece of it, he also projects in that sort of superstar category, like in the same conversation as players like Matvei Michkov and Macklin Celebrini and that kind of a echelon, just from a purely statistical standpoint. And then I think that Liga has been watered down over the last 5 to 10 years, but some of those kids that perform well in Liga, like Konsta Hellenius, do tend to typically get sort of bonus marks from any sort of model. And Hellenius wasn't just good in Liga this year. He was one of the best players on his team in Liga, including in the playoffs. A year ago, he played a full season in Liga. A year before that, 3 years ago now, he was one of the leading scorers at the U20 level. So there's anybody who has that sort of 3-year track record instead of 2-year track record typically gets a boost. So those guys come to mind. And then the one who actually surprised me when I was having a conversation with Byron about who jumped out in his model about a month ago is Michael Brandsegg-Nygaard, who is actually viewed as sort of a projectable player, a safe pick, a future middle six checker type who's physical and works hard and has kind of that Cole Beaudoin motor that we talked about, but not necessarily viewed as a points guy. And yet you look back at Michael Brandsegg-Nygaard's trajectory here and his production in Hockey Allsvenskan and his production before that at the J20 level, some of what he's done internationally, including with the men's team, scored 4 goals in a game 2 weeks ago now. He's actually a kid who I think gets more love from the models than people maybe realize. So I think maybe that's a sign that there's a little bit of offense there that people might not expect.
Yeah, tremendous playoffs in that league too. I think he had 10 points in 12 games, which is really impressive at that age. Chris, this one is for you. What are the chances of Demidov sliding to 5 for the Habs?
I mean, I don't think it's out of the question, you know, like I feel like it's unlikely based on, you know, I think that there's a lot of belief in him as being, you know, one of the top 3 forwards in this draft, you know? And so it's just a matter of, you know, confidence. I think the other thing is that he doesn't have a long contract in the KHL at the moment. You know, that is part of it. If he does sign an extension, I guess that would make things a little bit scarier, but you know, I think there's some interesting things that I've learned about, you know, from European scouts about, you know, the various things that have kind of been happening with Russia and everything else like that. And you know, I think most of them feel like the Russian risk isn't as high with him, just because of the certain things. He's also represented by Gold Star, which, you know, we've talked about, is that kind of, I guess, gives people some feeling of good feelings, because obviously Dan Milstein, they don't really love him in the KHL because of the amount of guys he has in the NHL. But you know, like that's another thing that I think is good. So is it impossible? I don't think so, because I think you look at some of those teams. If Chicago decides to take Levshinov, and then all of a sudden you're looking at, what are you going to do if you are if you're Anaheim. You know, you've got all those different things that you have. You got another chance to add another piece. I mean, does the run on defenseman happen in 3, you know, in 2, 3, 4? Is there something there so there's always the possibility that's there. I think it's a little unlikely, but at the same time, I don't think that it's impossible. And I do think that the Demidov hype train has like fired back up to a certain extent, to Corey's point earlier about that. And I don't think it's necessarily just to the playoffs and how he played in the playoffs. I think it's just a matter of that certainly played a role in terms of how the public has viewed him. But yeah, but I mean, I think that there's plenty to be excited about with him. And I think it's going to be hard for him to slip there, but certainly not impossible. I mean, we saw Matvei Michkov go down to 7 last year. So clearly there's a possibility.
Yeah, I agree with that, particularly the Michkov point. Although they would say the difference at the top of last year's draft was probably stronger than the top of this year's draft. Agreed, and I think that creates more of an avenue. I think people like Demidov more because of the contract, who's represented by. I think he has a play style with his compete that I think is very appealing and makes him very likable. But it's interesting if you start comparing him to, say, Matvei Michkov. You know, Demidov had a great draft season. Would you have argued, though, that Michkov had just as impressive, if not a better draft season, given what he accomplished versus men? You know, you look at their draft minus 1 years, I would argue Michkov's numbers were better than Demidov in the MHL in his draft minus one. You look at, you know, internationally, you know, Michkov is already with the senior team in his draft year. He was a world junior player in the draft minus one. Hlinka, you know, top player, U18 MVP, draft minus two. These are all things that Demidov just either didn't do or didn't have the opportunity to do. And so I think it's interesting how there's like, oh, he could go two, he'd be a consensus two, consensus three, and there's no way he's going to slide to five, but Michkov did. So I think, you know, kind of like I said earlier, small, you know, whether it's the fact that he's a winger, that he's a Russian, I think there's plenty of opportunity there for teams to talk their way out of him at two, three, four.
All right, last one is from Badelberg 14. Corey, we'll start with you here, but everyone feel free to chime in if somebody comes to mind. Who in this draft have you heard from teams is going to go way higher than expected by the public, like an Easton Cowan, for example?
Well, we've already mentioned Seneca. I think he's an easy one to talk about. I think we've talked about Beaudoin and Luchenko. I think those are guys who have helped themselves. I can be really lame and just go right to Easton Cowan's team. And I think Sam O'Reilly's a really nice prospect. He's, you know, 6'1" center. He skates well. He competes well. He's showing decent offense. He's been a big part of the success of that London team this year. And I'm not saying he's for sure going to go in the first round, but I wouldn't blink if that happened, quite honestly. I think he's a really nice player. And I would not put too high of a ceiling in terms of where Dean Letourneau is going to go. I know he played prep hockey, St. Andrews, but he's 6'7", and he could skate. And the toolkit's really tantalizing. And I think there's going to be an NHL team that's going to convince themselves to take him in the 20s.
It's two games in the USHL that he got. And I don't know how much you read into that. When you're picking a guy out of St. Andrews College here, like, it is one of those tricky things where you're betting a lot on just physical tools other than what you saw in that brief USHL stint.
I mean, he's toolsier than Mark Jankowski was, and Jankowski got taken out of Quebec High School.
And that worked out great.
I didn't say, you know, I was endorsing the idea, although I do love the player. And I think he is more athletic than him. When I watch him, the player I actually think of is someone near and dear to your heart, Max, is Rasmussen. I think there's a lot of, I can see a path where he becomes a player like that in the NHL.
Jack McBain did the OJ to BC path and Letourneau is a BC commit too. So there's some natural things there. But I think in watching Letourneau, there's finesse and skill to his game that some of those other big guys like McBain just never had at that same age.
All right. Good show today, guys. That's going to do it for us. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Athletic Hockey Show Prospect Series. You can catch more of Chris over at Flow Hockey and on his podcast, Talking Hockey Sense. Obviously, read all Scott and Corey's stuff on The Athletic. We'll talk to you soon.
What a show.